Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's May 8th, 2016, and welcome to episode 126 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting, and sometimes talking about holidays. My name is Jack Nutting, and with me we have two fine gentlemen all the way over in Australia, the other side of the world from me, really. We have Michael Mulhern. How are you doing, Michael?
Oh, all things considered, I'm doing pretty good today.
Good. How was your weekend?
Built a shed.
Nice. That's classic weekend stuff.
It is, and fortunately I timed it well. It's raining right now, so I can just sit back, relax, and look at my wonderful handiwork. And hopefully now I can get back to retro computers.
Nice. All right, also joining us today we have Paul Hagstrom over in Boston. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing pretty well. Just finished the academic semester, so the vista is opening up for retro computing tasks. Hopefully.
Excellent.
And I hear you rescued a hedgehog in a Sonic-type endeavor.
I did. I rescued an actual living hedgehog, very unlike Sonic the Hedgehog, actually. It's small and brownish and round. This thing was... So today was unusually an actually warm day in Sweden, which is pretty rare, especially this early in May. And I was actually lying in a sun chair, and I heard this weird sort of like... kind of thumping, hammering thing, and I didn't know what it was. And I looked over and I saw some plants moving, and so next to our porch, there's sort of a little area with some bushes and flowers and stuff, and there's a little sort of plastic gardening divider, and this little hedgehog was stuck on one side of the divider and couldn't figure out how to get around it because it was, it was too long for it to figure out how to wander all the way around it, and it was too high to climb over. So it was just like lying in a little sort of curled up in a ball. I don't know if it was like kicking or somehow pushing this little black divider against the porch to make this thump, thump, thump. Like he's just trying to sort of get out. I have no idea how long it had been in there doing that. And so I just like put on some thick gloves and reached down and picked him up and carried him over to our neighboring house where I know that I think there are some hedgehogs that live under that porch. I think that's probably where he came from. He came out and got, fell off our porch and got stuck down there and didn't know what to do. And it was pretty weird because... like wild animals, I'm used to them actually just typically being pretty afraid of humans and running away, but these things just are not. Like, and I've seen before, if you're sitting out in your yard, they can actually come walking right in front of your feet and nothing happens. Like, they know you're there and they're just like, okay, I'm not worried about you. And
your threat level is zero.
Yeah. Like they know that, like, short of actually being stomped on by a really large animal, like, no animal is going to be able to attack them successfully and try and eat them or something. Because they just ball up and stick their spikes out, and unless you have very big, heavy feet like a moose, or you have something sharp and pointy like a human would have, like they're safe. So these things, when you approach them, if they're in a bush, like they don't even run away, they just walk away. Like I've never seen one of these things run. The way you see a squirrel always runs or a rat or mouse runs, these things are just like, oh, here comes somebody, I'll just walk away. And when you get close enough that they can't avoid you anymore, then they just ball up and stick their spikes out. So I picked this thing up, and it was pretty cool. I picked it up. It was just like this little ball, and I had the gloves on, and my kids were sort of trying to pet it a little bit, kind of stroke right above its eyes. Like, it doesn't make any kind of aggressive, like, hissing or showing teeth or anything. It just kind of, like, as you approach with a finger, it kind of balls up more. It tries to ball up all it can. Maximum ball. Anyway, it was cool. And so then I just put it down and it walked away under the neighbor's porch. So that was my weekend. Pretty exciting.
Very nice.
Yep.
Yeah, I sort of like the you know, until you mentioned the bit about maybe having come from the neighbors, I kind of like the idea of just like, here, you guys deal with it.
Yeah, not my problem. Pass it off to my neighbors. Now, they often live like under porches, and we think we had seen these going in and out from the neighbor's porch before, so we just put it over there. And it very happily walked off under there, so I guess that's where it
I'm glad to see I'm not the only one having nature drop in to say hello.
Yeah, I guess Australia has a bit more animals that are not that afraid of humans, since humans haven't been there in great numbers for all that long, compared to other parts of the world. Is that possibly correct?
Oh, most of the animals here are still a little bit person shy. About the only one that ignored me was the echidna, but again, it uses the same defensive maneuver as the hedgehog, roll up into a spiky ball. So.
Right.
Yeah, the wallabies and the kangaroos, they all run away. There's a couple of birds, large birds that are sort of making our yard their hunting area, so they put up with us, but they won't let us get close. But no, it's nice having the little critters drop in to say hello.
Yep.
As long as they don't stay inside your retro computers. Aha, yep, back to my theme.
Yep. I keep the doors shut so the lizards can't get in here.
Yep. Good move. All right. Well, today, the day we're recording this, it is Mother's Day in the U.S. and in Australia. Not in Sweden, but that's okay. And we were talking about this because we're talking about, I think in the past we've had problems with Skype on Mother's Day. I guess that's probably a day when a lot of Skype is being used. And there's only so much Skype in the world to go around. So if everyone's using all the Skype, it's hard for us to do our talks. But so far, so good. But so we were thinking about this and thinking about the theme of absence. Because many of us, as we grow up, we don't live anywhere near our mothers. I sure don't. And so we say absence makes the heart grow fonder, right? And I'm sure all of us have had this experience with our retro computers. You think about something that you remember from years ago and think, oh man, that was a neat system. I would love to get my hands on one of those things again. And then when you finally get one of these things to actually play with, you kind of find, okay, well, oh, this actually, yeah, this is okay, but it's not quite as great as I feel like I remembered it. Like, while the time you didn't have it, you built it up bigger in your mind than it actually was. My first experience of this was actually my kind of first foray into retro stuff at all. In about 1994, I bought an Atari 2600 from a neighbor with a bunch of games. And I had played with the Atari 2600 as a kid in the late 70s and early 80s, but I'd never had one myself. But I remember, you know, playing games at a friend's house and that sort of thing. And so I bought the system, and it must have come with, I don't know, a few dozen games. And I was like, great, this is awesome. I've never had one of these. Finally, I, you know, get to play all the games. And I kind of tore through the core of all of those games in like an hour or two. It's like, okay, well, sure, these they were fun, but there was not a lot of depth, right? Like even in 1994, what was available in terms of computer games, video games, had gone so far beyond what could be done back in the olden days that it was not as great as it had sort of built up in my mind. How about you guys? Do you have a similar experience at all? Michael, how about you?
Well, mine would be the original Macintosh. Now, I was working for an Apple dealer when the Macs came out, and I distinctly remember being quite impressed. That's an understatement. You know, the resolution on the screen, just the form factor, and what it promised. It seemed to be the ultimate in computers. Never had actually got to use a Lisa, so it was the first time that I had really used a full graphical display, controlling it with the mouse and everything along those lines. So fast forward 25 years or so, maybe even 30, when I start acquiring retro computers, I get more involved in it, and it's slow, it's restrictive, 128K, you can't do much. It's got a single-sided 400K floppy disk. You know, very slow to switch between applications, and you go, I'm trying to like remember this as a wonderful experience, but unfortunately technology had moved on so far that it was now more difficult to use the original Mac than it was to, say, use a Commodore 64 or an Apple II. I felt more at home with them than I did with the Mac. Mind you, as soon as I got hold of a 512K Mac with a memory upgrade and the SCSI upgrade on it, everything sort of like felt pretty good. So it really shows to me that the original Mac might have been a little bit rushed out. It could have really have done with extra memory. And that might have just been enough for it, but you know, it was so strange using a 128K Mac. Wasn't an original; it was the second release as the 128. It sort of doesn't mesh with your golden memories. It was very disconcerting.
Sure. Mm-hmm. How about you, Paul?
Well, on the Mac thing, I was going to say that, you know, it's fun to use these, and I think I would have the same kind of feeling about the 128K one, but also even just a slightly more modern Mac. One of the things I recall is, you know, it's fun to use the disks. You hear, you know, with a disk drive sucking it in and making these, you know, the nice noises and things like that. And, you know, that's great. But when you get to the point of, all right, now insert disk 18, then it's like, all right. Yeah, at this part I don't really miss, but or just, you know, just all the different kind of conflicts that you can get between things, trying to set up like some kind of networking or whatever. Yeah, I mean, I think probably in reality that would be the Mac would be the same for me. You know, that watching it redraw slowly and stuff is not what I remember exactly. But one that I did not have, but you know, I've used a little bit recently, is the Lisa, and that's really slow. I mean, it's you know, it's hard. It's a little bit hard to imagine doing real work on it, even though it's cool. You know, it's neat that you can actually use the thing now. But I think if I actually wanted to try to get something done on it, it's not so great. So, I don't know. I mean, partly we're spoiled, I suppose, but I don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing I found is that when all the graphical user interfaces were coming out, you know, the hardware wasn't quite up to it, and I just find it quite amazing that I'll go back to using a computer that is text and line based and enjoy doing the programming and everything on that, but if I go on to a early Mac using Mac Basic or any of the graphical database tools and things, everything just seems to just be that little bit more difficult. So, you know, I think it's more using today's paradigm of the graphical user interface and then just trying to struggle with that on the hardware of the 80s is, to me, is where I find the big problem. So you got today's expectations with yesterday's hardware.
Yep.
But it is also sort of interesting to see. I mean, it highlights a little bit how stuff has changed. I mean, because things don't act quite like you would expect. The Lisa, you know, getting back to that, is really quite, it takes some getting used to. It's not a Mac at all. you know, everything is operated in different ways, even though it all looks pretty similar. So, but yeah, it's true. I mean, like text-based machines, I don't feel that same kind of disappointment in that, you know, like working at the command line, it's still quick. It's not many characters across, but it's still quick.
Right. I think actually I had a very similar experience with the original Mac, but I had it much, much longer ago. So this was probably in about 1987 or 88 when I was still primarily using Atari 8-bits. And I remember going on a school trip of some kind, and we were like staying. Like all of us were staying with families or something at the place we were visiting, and the place I was visiting, they're like, "Oh, here, you can sleep in this room." By the way, you know, this is our son's room, but he's out of town or whatever. But he's got this Mac, and you can play with it. He's got some games on it and whatever. And at that time, I had seen Macs probably in stores, probably only in stores. And I remember like playing with Mac Draw and that kind of thing, but I never actually used one. I didn't have any friends who had any yet. It was pretty early on still. And I remember, like, I understood how to boot it up and how to get things to happen. But the thing that that was really frustrating was that it seemed to require an incredible amount of swapping floppies. Like, you had to kind of put the system floppy back in all the time to load stuff. And this is probably, again, due to the low amount of RAM that, like, it had to sort of load things in and out. And it was just like, I was amazed at how incredibly frustrating it was to use the machine, just that every program seemed to want to reload some system stuff at some point and just, like, please insert the system disk. And, like, so that was the kind of thing where I think I had built up, despite never having used it, I had in my mind an impression of that original Mac as being more powerful than it actually was. And once I started using it, it's like, wow, this is kind of a pain.
Well, it does sort of seem like it's a kind of a common theme that software jumps ahead a little faster than hardware, because the 68,000 is, you know, I think it's indisputably more powerful than the things that preceded it. But they tried to put software that's like 1.5 times harder to run on it. So, because it seems like, you know, if we had just a machine that was trying to do what the Apple II was doing with a 68,000 in it, it would be amazing. But no.
Right. Yeah. Yep, kind of got ahead of themselves a bit. All right. Well, let's move along here. We've got a bit of listener feedback. We heard from a guy named Edward Newman. He's the creator of the Pocket Pokey that we talked about back in episode 122. The Pocket Pokey is it's sort of a freestanding synthesizer unit, MIDI controllable, built around an actual Pokey chip as exists in the Atari 8-bit computers. And we talked about this, and he wanted to thank us for the kind words and just to mention that, like, the price he's charging for this thing, because I think I said it was kind of seemed a little bit expensive. He said he's basically charging very little more than what his actual material costs are. That because he's making these things in small amounts and cannot really do volume discounts on what he's buying. So it is what it is. Anyway, he's selling these things still on eBay and Etsy, and he said he's working on other things as well. So you might want to check it out. He has an Etsy store that is called Chocolate Chiptronics. So thank you, Ed, for writing in to us. Oh, and also Mark from the Bletchley Park podcast says thanks for the shout-out. We mentioned them, and we had a bit of email back and forth. And, yeah, so hello, Mark. Thank you for thanking us for the shout-out. Okay, that's all the feedback we're going to tackle right now. Let's move along to some news items. And the first one up is me. I have a bit of a news item. It's not really that much news, actually, but it's interesting. So Chris Crawford is a guy who famously worked at Atari in the early 80s. He made games like Eastern Front and I forget what it's called. There's a game that's like a nuclear reactor simulator. Anyway, and he worked there for a while. He's written books about game programming, all sorts of things. And one of the things that he did early in the 80s there was make a series of videos teaching you how to program the Atari 8-bit computers, specifically teaching you about how the different sort of functions of the chips doing the video processing, that sort of thing. And these videos are now on YouTube, and they're pretty fun and funny. There's a lot of graphics and a lot of sort of fun stuff, and a lot of the graphics that are made to demonstrate the things are, of course, graphics that are made on an Atari 8-bit computer using the techniques he's explaining. It's very meta. So anyway, there's some videos here. We'll have a link in the show notes to the Gamma Sutra page that mentions this and links out to the first of these videos.
That's cool. Yeah, I haven't watched this, but I'm like looking at little bits of it now, and it's very funny little skits of him standing in front of, you know, the computer graphics and dodging things, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's obviously it's 80s era computer graphics, but we all like that. And not that often you see graphics of that era actually mixed with video and stuff. So it was pretty cool. Pretty fun.
So how was this distributed? I mean, like how would one have gotten this in the 80s? Do you know?
That I don't know. I don't remember. I think on the sort of on the header of the video at the front, it sort of mentions something about, like, there's some title screen, I think, at least it shows sort of where this came from. Mm-hmm. But it's for sure nothing that I ever felt like I saw or had access to. So
yeah, it says Atari Computer Enthusiasts to Support, ACE.
Yeah.
Video Visits, Service Mark.
Yeah, so whatever that organization was, apparently they were distributing this. So anyway, worth checking out if you're interested in how these old graphics worked. He explains a lot of stuff, and he wears costumes, and like he's like dressed up as an antic chip and stuff like that. It's all pretty funny. There's lots of props.
And crazy antics.
Crazy antics of the antic chip. Yep. Michael, you have some news from WASFest.
Yes, well, at the end of our last show, I just mentioned that I was going to be heading off to WASFest 3 here in Sydney, and just wanted to report back that not only was there a hardware announcement, there was actually two hardware announcements. So, new to the Apple IIgs world, we announced the 4Play card and the 4Sonic card. So, the 4Play card is actually a digital joystick support, so it allows you to run up to four digital joysticks as opposed to the analog variety that the Apple GS supported. So if you've got all those nice Atari digitals, you can plug them into a 2GS. And if you're going to be playing a four joystick game, well, what better game would be Kaboom, which is a Bomberman clone that was updated to handle the input from four joysticks. So on the night there, we actually had four people playing Kaboom at the same time. It was quite frantic and lots of fun.
Cool.
But to top the night off, as equally impressive, is the 4Sonic card. So the Apple IIgs has stereo, two-channel support. So with the 4Sonic card plugged in, you've now got four-channel support. And for all of those people out there that have got all their expansion slots in the 2GS filled up after just putting in their 4Play card, the good thing about the 4Sonic is that it only draws power off the slot. So if you use a power adapter, you don't even need to take up a slot for the 4Sonic. So there's no reason why 2GS users now can't go and have 4-channel sound in their GS. Unless, of course, they want 8-channel sound. So this is where the 4Sonic gets real good. If you get two 4Sonics and a cable to actually pair them together, you'll be able to have 8 channels of blazingly brilliant sound out of your 2GS. So, funnily enough, the authors of Kaboom also updated the sound support. Unbeknownst to either of the hardware developers, they both thought that they were doing the hardware announcement on the night. But the surprise was that each found out that there was also another hardware announcement. So,
cool.
It was a fun night. And then, of course, there was just all the usual camaraderie, pulling machines apart, putting them together. Young Charlie joined in, so we put together an Apple IIc bundle, a machine, external drive, and monitor, because getting young people involved in retro computers is a good thing. And I had a spare copy of Sophistication and Simplicity by Stephen Wyrick, and I gave that to Charlie as well, so he could get an Apple II history of the machines. And then also, just to top off the night, I brought along a little something special, because I figured if we were going to have all of these 80s computers sitting around doing things, we're going to be doing all this hardware announcements and whatnot. So I took along a bottle of 1987 vintage port. So we're playing with 80s hardware. What better thing to do than have a little bit of 80s port to just top the night off? So it was a good night. So I'd like to say a big thank you for Sean for hosting, and to Alec and John for their hardware announcements. And hopefully we'll see those two cards available soon.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Cool. It's great that all those things lined up all at once.
I think it took a little bit of organizing on Sean's part. So
sure.
it was very well done. Very impressive. I'm just glad to see that there is still new hardware development out there for our retro machines. So it's great to see new interpretations of and support for things that there. But to have on the same night two new cards to extend the capabilities of the Apple IIgs. It was great, and you know, I just love it when I find out about, you know, new hardware that's being developed for any of our machines. It's just, as I said, we're in a golden age of peripherals and expansions for our retro machines. It's just great.
Cool. I have a question about that 4Sonic card, and I don't really know anything about the 2GS audio, but you mentioned that it only actually needs power. So if it only needs power, how does it actually do anything?
Well, it picks it up off the audio off the motherboard.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really up on the side there, but John's got details of from the link in there.
Okay.
So basically, I suppose it's a bit of a cheat. As I said, it's only using the slot to pick up the power. You do actually have to plug it in to various parts on the motherboard to pick up the...
Okay.
Yeah.
I see. Got it. Interesting. Cool.
But so the... I mean, as I understand it, it's basically taking... Well, maybe I don't understand it. So the Ensoniq chip itself can generate 32 different voices at once, but this allows you to distribute them. Is that what's happening?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, this actually it reminds me, although it's not maybe totally directly related, to this discussion that they just had on OpenApple 58, where they interviewed someone whose name... they apparently spent a long time trying to figure out how to pronounce, and then I have now forgotten. But it's something like Huibert Albers, who was the author of Soundsmith, and he was talking about putting that together partly as a way to kind of like show that the 2GS could really like outshine the Amiga, right? You know, in certain areas. So I mean, I think that the 2GS sound capabilities are pretty impressive. So this does seem like it's nice to sort of unlock it.
Yeah, this stock GS always did sound pretty good, apart from having only the mono out support to keep Apple Core happy. But
yeah, that's cool. Never made much sense to me that they had the super, you know, super chip in there and then just a mono out.
Yeah, well, that was to do with Apple not getting involved in music.
Oh, the Beatles thing.
Yeah, with the Beatles Apple Core. Yeah, so yeah. We see how well that worked out in the end.
Yeah. Oh, well.
All right, cool. That sounds like it was a pretty exciting WASFest. Paul, what did you get for us? You have some other Apple II news.
Yeah, I figured we'd kind of group this stuff together. So a couple of other things have been announced recently. So the first one is a hardware thing also. Ultimate Micro has now released, or at least they're taking orders for, a new universal power supply, which is a really cool thing. So, you know, this is the time when everyone's power supplies are dying. And like a lot of times what you need to do is there's a capacitor or something that you need to replace. Is that what it is? I don't know. There's something that sort of like conditions the line a little bit, and that tends to blow in a smoky and stinky way. And so it is possible to repair your power supplies. But what Ultimate Micro has done is they've figured out they've got a modern power supply, and they've printed a PCB that you can use to actually put in side the case of your existing power supply and, you know, sort of replace it, but in a way that will last into the future. You don't have to worry about the thing, you know, smoking and so forth. It's definitely one of the things that I have been kind of anxious about. You know, I always worry that when I turn this on, this is going to be the time when it blows. And so I'm quite interested in this. But it's a really neat thing. They've set it up so that it works in basically all Apple IIs and Apple III. Hmm. And when I say all, I think I am excluding the 2C, but they give instructions on how you open up the power supply, and there's a big long green PCB that you mount the sort of main power supply unit on, and you break it off at certain points depending on which case you're trying to get it into, and it's got all the places for screws to go in and all the places to mount and all the connectors so that you can get it out. So once you've sealed it back up, it does look, you know, it looks just like it used to, but except more reliable.
I could have done with one of those at WASFest, because we had a smoker and one machine's power supply went.
Oh no.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm pretty excited about this. They're taking. I think they're going to start shipping them at the end of July. And if you are going to Kansas Fest, there's a special where they will bulk ship them to Kansas Fest and hand them out there. So the kit is $90, $89.99 at Kansas Fest, or $99.99 just to be mailed. And there are a couple of other pieces that you... Oh, that's interesting. Actually, I think they've added some things since I looked at this last. But it is possible to buy the power supply by itself without their connectors and their PCB if you want to kind of do this yourself. So I have, in fact, ordered, I think, one of those. Maybe two. I don't remember now. Because I'm hoping that on the way to Kansas Fest, I can build a kind of like a portable Apple III. They have the cables that you need to plug this universal, the actual power supply box into the Apple III. And so I'm going to see if I can kind of rig something up, you know, without a power supply at all, except for this thing. But we'll see. I've got a keyboard connector coming that hopefully will allow me to plug in a USB keyboard and this power supply, and I'll have a SD card floppy. So it'll be pretty much like, you know, pretty brain in a vat kind of Apple III, but at any rate. So this is good. This is a neat development. Nice. I'm hoping that they keep selling it for a long time, because I think this is a very useful. And there's actually also Chris Torrance has made a video in his Assembly Lines podcast series that sort of shows him installing it into an Apple II. So you can watch that if you want to see what's involved, but not much is involved.
I could have done with one of these new power supplies actually back in the 80s at university. They had a whole computer lab full of Apple II Euro pluses, and every time you turned them on, it was like a snap, crackle, pop fizz using the switch on the back. I think it was more the rocker switch than anything else, but it was very disconcerting powering them on. You're sort of like, we're expecting the machine to explode and shards of plastic flying everywhere, but we seem to survive. Now, it's good to see some new power supplies coming out.
Yeah. And then just a quick other thing I wanted to mention was that Structress, the Apple II game written by Martin Hay, is now available for iOS through Call Apple. So you can find it on the iTunes Store, and of course I didn't look up how much it costs, but it's, you know, it's not free, but it's sort of app priced. I played it a bit, and I'm not very good at it, but it looks good, has a nice soundtrack, and you can sort of tell that behind the scenes it is running in an emulator. So, I mean, it is the Apple II game, but controllable from your phone.
Cool. So it's actually, they didn't like rewrite it for iOS. They actually installed it using an Apple II emulator.
Yeah, I'm pretty certain of that.
Nice. I checked on the App Store. It looks like it costs $1.99, which is outrageously expensive. This is the sad life of people who
things
deal
have
with
changed.
Trying to sell apps. It's like, oh my God. People are just freaking out about something costing $2. Anyway, I will go out and buy it after the show. Just because. Because
okay.
I've actually never played Structress, because I've never had an Apple II even. I know you guys talk about this game, but I've never played it. So.
Oh, and this is a new game. I mean, it's I forget how long ago it was written, but a couple of years ago.
Right. Yeah, I think I remember hearing about Kansas Fest having a competition to make a program that would play Structress or something like that.
Well, I think Kevin Savitz wrote an autoplayer for this,
right?
If I'm not mistaken. So he his Hackfest entry.
Oh right, that was his Hackfest entry, right? That was the thing.
Yeah. But yeah. Anyway, so it's basically sort of like Tetris. I mean, it's kind of themed on Tetris, except that what you're a little dot that's trying to dodge the pieces falling, and the pieces fall at your dot. So you sort of use the dot to fill in the spaces, but yet not get crushed.
Right. Cool. All right, cool. Thanks, Paul. I have a little note here. Rob McMullen of Player Missile Podcast fame is working on a tool called Omnivore. This is a disk image editor for Atari 8-bit disk formats. It's open source and cross-platform, and basically what this does is lets you open up a disk image format, any of the popular 8-bit or Atari 8-bit image formats. It will open up and let you edit them. There's a hex editor. There is a disassembler, which is cool, and there's also a thing that will allow you to interpret segments of this as graphics. So as graphics that are stored in ways that are typical for loading stuff into the Atari-friendly video modes, you can actually display them and, of course, edit them. So Looks pretty sweet. I have not tried it yet. When I first heard that this was cross-platform, I got this lump in my chest because I was like, oh, no, this is going to be a Java app, isn't it? This is going to be a desktop Java app I've got to run. But no, it's written in Python, which is means it's, at least it's not written in Java. So, you know, so I'm sure it's built using, you know, Qt or whatever people use for making Windows-y apps with Python, which is, you know, so on the Mac, it's not going to look like a Mac app really, but that's fine. I'm sure it'll be just fine. But anyway, for the functionality, it looks very cool. So if you're interested in poking around in any Atari disk images, Omnivore is the way to go. And there are links in the show notes. And like I said, it's open source, so it's all on GitHub. If you feel like you want to make changes and help out, go do it.
Excellent.
Yeah, I think this is looks like this is the kind of tool that I really wish I would have had back then. Like I remember having some tools on my Atari 8-bit for doing some of this kind of stuff, but you know what you can do now is so far beyond what was possible. So I'm looking forward to playing with that. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
Michael
uses WXPython.
Oh, WXPython, right? That's like the thing. That's
And also requires something. It's some kind of numeric package that you have to install. Which I at least when you install it, you have to type pip install numpy.
Okay. I
have always liked the name.
Yeah, numpy. Oh, numpy. Sounds like some sort of strange nickname. Yeah, so apparently there are binaries for Windows and OS X, and you only have to install numpy if you're doing it on Linux, doing it manually. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, looks pretty cool. I'm looking forward to playing with it at some point. Moving on, Michael, you have something. I don't know what this is.
Okay, well, quite often we talk about how our retro computers are great learning models for understanding how a computer works, how the different sections all interact, the programming language, normally BASIC, and how it's all in one easy self-contained unit that's quite simple to pick up and learn. But what I have here is called the mega processor. So what James has done is he has taken the microcomputer and writ it large. So imagine the panels that you would see at a computer exhibition with everything there. But now make each of those panels the separate section. So, you know, one is memory, one is your general purpose registers, there's all your I.O. And your desk is just a little bit sitting in the middle. So on the link that we'll provide to megaprocessor.com, if you have a look at the progress tab, you will see what he has currently built so far, and with the ribbon cables connecting all the different parts of the unit, and there's the table with the LCD monitor and the keyboard all sitting in there. Now, what scares me is what's he going to do when he makes the floppy disk? Is it going to be a 5.5-foot floppy?
Oh,
so
man.
It's not really retro, but I just thought that this was going in totally the opposite direction to how we normally try to illustrate theory and concepts of programming and computer use using our old 8-bit machines. Here is someone who has gone and used macro scale architecture and components to actually build it. So just instead of using integrated circuits, he's using individual transistors. I would just love to see this in the flesh, so to speak. But if you want to see something different in the wonderful world of not so micro computing, this is the place to go. And it is just unbelievable. I just love it. There are some strange people out there, and I'm so glad to count James at megaprocessor.com as one of us.
This is astonishing. This is
truly
a thing to behold. Like I the panorama showing this giant thing spread all around this room. This is amazing.
Yeah, you don't think that you would have to do a panorama photo of a computer these days, a modern day computer. So one, two. I can actually, there's 8 elements in this photo panorama that's been stitched together. It is unbelievable. It is great.
And we should mention each of these elements is like roughly like a 3-foot by 6-foot board with stuff all over it, kind of.
These are big panels. The panels that you would normally expect on display at a computer expo. So if you went to CeBIT and any of the computer expos, that's the kind of panels that you would expect to see in a seller's exhibit space. And in this case here, this is his computer. It's definitely not a microcomputer.
Wild.
I think it would be really super interesting to watch this, but yeah.
And so much ribbon cable connecting it all together, especially our old favorite rainbow ribbon cables. It's just great.
So now the question would be though, you know, if it breaks, if it stops working in some way, then what?
Oh, it's just like a modern computer. You'd unplug the panel that's not working and put a new one in.
Yes, of course.
It's all plug and play.
I haven't figured out. So, what is it? What's the model for this? Is it a particular microprocessor that he's modeling, or is it kind of his own design?
It's a bit of his own design, but there is so much depth in there. Programming is to do. So he has an assembler and simulator in a zip file, megaprocessor, that offers the state of the art as it was in 2014. Runs in a DOS box. So there's programming and things. So it's really coming along.
He mocked it up with an FPGA board too.
So I'm just going to peripherals to see if there is going to be I would love to see a floppy drive, but there's shots of the memory board. So it has 32K of RAM, probably because that was all it could fit on the partition.
Right. It seems like there's a joystick that's about as big as one of the LCD monitors.
Yeah, he went for the biggest joystick he could find.
Yeah, as I said, it's not technically retro computing, but it was just too good to let this one go.
Yep. That's amazing.
Good find. I'm going to have to spend some time reading this, I think.
Do we know where this is, where in the world he is?
I believe he's in Cambridge.
Okay.
I'm just trying to find out which one.
Yeah, at the top it says, you know, what, how, why, short answer, because I want to. Where? Here, Cambridge. Who? Me, James. Very nice.
Let's see. He's featured in a couple of articles on the Register and BBC News, so I would say that it is the original Cambridge,
right.
not one of the Cambridge clones.
Hey, now.
Not a Cambridge
clone. Sorry, one of the modern implementations of Cambridge.
Right. Well, this is amazing. Let's move on to the next thing. Paul, you've got some news that has popped up about some old compact laptops.
Yeah, so quite recently, I guess this is on Jalopnik.com, there was a story that's been kind of circulating around that McLaren Automotive is still using DOS-based software to service the remaining 100 McLaren F1s that there are. And the McLaren F1, it says they built 106 of them. There are 100 that still exist today. It is called the world's greatest supercar, and it's got all kinds of like custom pieces, and it's built of gold and all kinds of stuff. But there's something inside this car that can be communicated with only with a certain compact laptop. So McLaren is even now still looking for compact LTE 5280 laptops from the early 1990s, because it runs a particular CA card. I don't know what CA stands for, but anyway. So, you know, it says McLaren F1s might be worth north of $13 million nowadays, but they can only maintain them if they have these compact laptops. So, so if you have one, it might be worth an awful lot.
Well, the CA stands for conditional access, so now I'm just trying to figure out what that actually means.
So I read an article on The Verge that says that, let's see, well, it actually mentions the Jalopnik article. Someone explains that it's a conditional access card. Modern PCs use smart cards or USB keys with special access codes to access sensitive systems. The CA card was used as a custom hardware as part of an integrated system for security and copy protection.
Aha. Aha. So it's DRM again, biting us.
Apparently so.
Tailor-made CA cards to access custom hardware as part of integrated system and security copy protection. Well, there's those two words which I don't like, copy protection.
Yes.
DRM, yuck.
Yep.
Ouch. Oh. Anyway, but yeah, so if this picture of this, you know, unremarkable otherwise looking little laptop looks familiar from something you just saw in your closet, just be aware of what it is before you throw it away.
I just wonder why only this laptop has or can work with that CA card. Like, what is, like, if there's some special interface in that laptop that they had instead of PCMCIA, like, we had this one weird thing, and someone made this one-off weird CA card that stuck on that one weird thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure. I mean, so the words that I said were, you know, a bit like all the hype that I was reading as they went around the internet, but yet there is one, you know, on eBay. You can buy for $320. So it's not like you're gonna. It's not like Apple One prices here. I think it's just. I think the remark was basically that the company was spending a bunch of money to get these, and why were they buying these old laptops? And here's why they were buying these old laptops. But yeah, it seems hard to believe that this is the only thing that can support that card.
Right.
So clearly, this is something that needs a bit more digging.
Right.
It was a nice sensational story, at least.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of bounced around everywhere, and you didn't hear it here first, folks. Anyway, that wraps up all the news we're going to cover today. Let's move on to a word from our sponsor.
Apparently, some people can't remember the name of the computer that my brother-in-law Rob recommends. Well, here's how to remember it. Computers often make people quite angry.
John?
See? Computers often make people quite... Computers often make people...
Can I show them mine?
Nearly works.
C-O-M-P-A-Q.
What?
C-O-M-P-A-Q.
I prefer mine. Computers often make people...
Character sets are also handled indirectly.
Give me an A.
Since a character set is too big to put into a register, we put the character set in memory and use a register to point to it.
Give me an A.
By changing the pointer, we can change the character set that Antic uses. This allows a program to use different character fonts. It also allows graphics character sets. Did you ever wonder what's really going on in Space Invaders?
Okay, it's time for the host's retro computing gift idea. It being Mother's Day, we started thinking about motherboards. And the thing that we have found is from motherboardgifts.com. Which has a variety of products made out of motherboards. The thing that we've chosen to highlight is Nightlight. So if you're feeling sad because you're far away from your mother who cannot comfort you at night anymore in the dark hours of your nighttime life, you can get this motherboard Nightlight that will have a light bulb behind it and will glow in comforting green or red or yellow tones. Or blue, apparently. So... anyway, it looks pretty cool. And if you go and poke around more on motherboardgifts.com, you find all kinds of things made out of old motherboards. They got binders and checkbooks and jewelry and magnets and all you want. Everything you ever wanted made out of a motherboard, they got it.
Yeah, no, these do look pretty pleasant. And I will just hope that they're not vintage, you know, like 80s motherboards. But and hopefully they don't have a bunch of lead in them. But at any rate,
you get one of these and you wreck it. It's like, oh my God, this is from an Apple One.
It's an Apple One.
What have they done? All right.
You could probably make about maybe 6 or 8 nightlights out of an Apple One PCB.
Oh yeah, they're pretty large. Yeah.
All right. Should we move along? Getting up to the eBay auctions. I'm going to go up here first. I found something interesting to me anyway. This is a retro game console. This is a clone of something called the Hanamex SD070. So this is an interesting thing. I looked this up. I stumbled across this thing on eBay, and I'd never heard of it. This was a thing from the early 80s. This is a PAL device. It won't work in the U.S. all that well, maybe. And this is basically a cartridge-based video game. I don't know how many games were available for this, but it was made in such a way that it was not exactly an open platform, but almost an open platform designed to be easily clonable. And this particular one that's on sale, it's not branded Hanamex. It is actually kind of unbranded. But apparently it works and has a few games that come with it. There are screenshots or photos of some of these games running on a television of some kind. So, looks interesting. It has two joysticks and a cartridge slot and switches for things like you would see on other video game consoles at the time. A volume slider, which is interesting. Anyway, this seems interesting. I'd never heard of this. I stumbled across it, but it looks kind of cool. You guys heard of this thing at all? Hanamex?
Nope. It does look cool, though.
Yep. And there are, we'll also include a link in the show notes to a page describing this that is on oldcomputers.com. So there are a number of these clones that have varying numbers of joysticks and different kind of slightly different features and things, but all the same basic functionality. That's my pick. Michael, what do you have for us?
Well, I like business software on our retro machines, and the original, I suppose, killer business application was VisiCalc. So I've always been quite impressed on the number of machines that had VisiCalc, but unfortunately, VisiCalc normally sells for silly dollars. Hundreds of dollars sometimes, especially the earlier ones I've seen for the TRS-80 and for the Apple that come in the faux leather binder, hard slip case and everything, and they normally go for $150, $200, sometimes even more. But every now and again, a VisiCalc for a machine will pop up for a more than reasonable price. So the first one I've got here is for an Atari 800, VisiCalc, and it's going for the princely sum of $1,779 US dollars. Now, there's also a couple of other auctions currently going, which I won't include listings for exactly the same product, that are actually going for $100, $200. They are a bit in considerably better condition than this, but it just shows that if you're after an original VisiCalc disc and manuals for your retro machine, that every now and again a quite reasonably priced edition is going to pop up. You just got to be patient. In the meantime, I'd say use something that you've downloaded or borrowed. But this one, the box is a little bit tatty, but the insides looks fairly good.
Yeah, it looks like the disc is inside a plastic sleeve inside the box there, like a binder-type sleeve. So it looks like it's probably just fine.
Yeah, the disc is definitely in good shape. And actually, I don't think of VisiCalc as being...
Yeah, not normally an Atari item either. Yeah.
Right. So it's possible that that's part of why this hasn't been snapped up. This particular auction is going to end before this goes out, but this is the third relist on this, so it probably will be relisted again by the time this comes out. So, and actually, the link that you'll click on in the show notes is probably going to be to that relisted one, unless somebody buys it in the next 9 hours.
Right.
But yeah, so particularly if you wanted to display it, picking up one for a platform that people don't care about it very much on is perfect, because otherwise this looks exactly like the other ones. It just, somewhere says Atari in small print.
Yeah, I've got a few copies of VisiCalc for the different machines. I've basically been trying to concentrate on the older editions that come in the brown vinyl soft binder, and normally with a hard slip or whatnot. But what also got me thinking is that in the age of VisiCalc, there were so many different add-on extension softwares and bits and pieces for it. And also, of course, There were books about using VisiCalc, and what I have here in my next auction link is for the VisiCalc audio course from Personal Tutor Associates. Now, I suppose it's because VisiCalc was such a new concept as far as personal computer software went that there was a great opportunity for different add-ons and books on how to use VisiCalc. There were kits on supplying effectively pre-generated spreadsheets for different functions and modeling. But it's always good to see some of the early day audio courses. So you'd get a flip box with normally 2-3 audio cassettes in it and some companion material. And it was to hopefully take you through using VisiCalc actually on your computer if you just followed the audio course. So in this one here, a little bit on the expensive side, $70 US, but I've seen this kind of audio software running for a lot more. Again, it's something different from a bygone age of how these new programs were introduced to the non-computer user in the business market.
Right. Cool.
But as far as an option one, this one's a little bit on the more boring side. So unless you're like me and you sort of like getting business software and the related paraphernalia that went with it, but it seems to be in good condition. The shrink wrap seems to have a bit of that genuine, almost falling off look about it.
One thing I was going to say about the your first item, the VisiCalc, is that if you look closely at the cover, there's a sticker in the upper left corner that it says that at one point, this thing, somewhere, sometime, cost $1. There's a little printed price tag on it. So at some point, somebody was bargain basement selling this thing for $1.
Yeah, but I could imagine, you know, 1993 or whatever.
Sure. Yeah. Who would be buying that? Yep.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, Paul, you have a selection of interesting items to talk about.
Yeah, okay, so I have, they're all just kind of oddball things, I think, in a way. But so the first one is a Tatung Einstein computer. So I feel like I had heard about these before, but it didn't look familiar when I saw it. So this particular one, it is in great shape. It kind of looks like a typewriter. It has kind of, I don't know, it's kind of hard to say exactly what it looks like. It has a kind of a unique look, but this is the, I think, what is it called? The ETC01. There were two models of the Tatung Einstein. The TC01 is the first one, and later there was a 256. And so it was a Z80 machine, and it could, you know, so it did run CPM, or a CPM-compatible operating system called CrystalDOS, spelled X-T-A-L-DOS. And it actually, it looks pretty cool. One of the things that was interesting about it was that it basically, when you turn it on, it jumps into the monitor. So it was used apparently for a lot of development work on all kinds of platforms. So people used this to write stuff for the Spectrum and for the Amstrad CPC and Commodore 64 as well. I would be actually pretty interested to try it out. I think this also used a 3-inch disk, which, you know, those are not easy to find at this point. Although there are out there on the web, there are things that tell you how you can kind of like cram a 3.5-inch disk in there. So, but anyway, yeah, this one looks really nice. It is starting. It has no bids now. As we record it, there are 5 days. Almost 6 days left. It is £50, or about $72, and to me it would be $36-$37 to ship, or £25. But so it's not crazy expensive. I don't know how the bids will go. Nobody has bid on it yet. It's been up for a day or so. But anyway, do either of you know anything about this computer? I feel like more ignorant than I should about it, but it looks very interesting.
Yeah, I have no idea. Never heard of this thing.
No, I've like you, I was aware of it. I can't remember where I've seen pictures of it, but I've never seen one on a desk or played with it.
Mm-hmm. And it does seem to work. I mean, like so I don't think this one comes with the monitor. And that was actually one of the things I was trying to figure out, like what kind of what monitor requirements there are. But because usually there is a monitor that normally goes with it. But I don't. My guess is that it doesn't require it. But anyway, there's a picture of the boot up screen on a monitor they don't intend to include. So it does seem to be working.
Yeah, I notice it also says in the text, it says, it's just for the computers. I have no box, leads, or software. But they must have some so-called leads because they're plugged in and turned on and plugged into a monitor of some kind. So.
The mains appears to be hardwired.
Okay. Sure. Hmm. But like you said, Paul, it suggests that there is a monitor cable because they have a picture of it plugged into something, it looks like. So.
I'm just trying to read the text underneath the various ports on the right-hand side of the machine itself.
Volume, analog 1, analog 2, RS-232, and TV. So TV, that sounds promising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably just a standard composite out, I guess. Cool.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, so... If nobody's bid on this by the time this ticks down, I'm not 100% sure that I can keep myself away from it. But looks very—it's very nice, though. So, okay, next one is a kind of a weird one that came up. It is a Eureka A4, and I know probably less about this even than about the other one. But it is a—it is basically a Braille input device, but I think it is also a computer as well. So, it had a Braille keyboard, voice output, built-in modem. A rich portfolio of word processing, educational and personal organizer functions, a ROM-based operating system, and even a sophisticated music composer. And there's I'm reading this off a webpage that has a picture of Stevie Wonder with his Eureka using it, apparently. Yeah, so apparently this is specifically for entering input in Braille, and it didn't actually occur to me that this would be something that you'd need to do, but I can see how that would be useful. It would be kind of fun to play with it. I do see a couple of YouTube videos, so might be possible to sort of see it in action without actually buying this one. But this does appear to be in quite nice shape. It's $69 buy it now in Quebec, Canada. So to me it would be $29 shipping. So it's not a trivial purchase, but it's kind of a unique, interesting thing.
Yeah, it looks very cool. I love the look of these buttons, and especially since it's meant for blind people, so the buttons, of course, have no print on them. But just that they have sort of a peculiar layout, which I guess is probably easy to feel with your fingers and get to know what's what. Cool. Yeah, I had seen this listed on some other auctions, and at the bottom, I clicked through and was like, what is this thing? But I have never heard of it before.
It is a serial number 0131, which the seller has a annotated along with about like 20 exclamation points. I guess that's a low number.
Seems low.
But
and it's also said made in Australia.
Oh yeah, I noticed that.
How about that?
Yeah, I'm just not familiar with it. So
Robotron is apparently the company. Robotron or Eureka A4. Anyway, very cool. And I guess the last thing I was going to mention was there's a chip. It is a Commodore 64, SX64 PLA replacement for the U17 PLA chip. It is called the MyTech Platinum with PLA capitalized. And so I don't know very much about this. I was gonna ask Earl about it, but he's not here. But apparently this is a chip in the Commodore 64 series computers that is kind of coordinating everything that happens in the machine, but also is a somewhat failure-prone point. And so this is it's a replacement for it. It is made from, it's very modern. What CPLD, what does CPLD stand for? But it's something FPGA-like, I think, in its construction. Yeah, anyway, I'm not sure exactly how it's made, but it's clearly got like a little modern chip and, plugs into the place where the PLA was, has an onboard regulator and status indicators, I guess, if you're heavier, lid off. But anyway, so if you have a Commodore 64 that has a failed PLA, this is a replacement that you can buy. It costs $25, free shipping. And actually, I had found this and I picked it out, and then I was just listening to episode 12 of the History of Personal Computing, where they also mentioned this and spoke possibly slightly more knowledgeably than I just did about this. But so if you want to listen to episode 12 or follow the links to the show notes, there's Jeff mentions a little bit about this PLA replacement. So anyway, I wanted to make sure that it was something people were aware of. There is a little picture of how it looks inside. I guess maybe, yeah, the LED might be visible if you were staring in the back ports with the cover on. But anyway, so.
Cool.
That's it. Looked like an interesting thing. It looks like it might be interesting to use this process on chips for other computers as well. I'm kind of curious to know a little bit more about it.
Yeah, to see this sort of procedure for other computers that have chips that tend to go bad, could be reconstructed from scratch in this way. Cool.
And then we wonder, like, is this still a retro computer? And then we, you know, gnash our teeth and and talk about it on yet another host topic.
Yeah, actually, I got a bit confused with this one because there have been U17 replacements, and the one I was actually thinking of was the Plankton, but that's over on the over in Jack's neck of the woods, Commodore 64.se. Mm-hmm. So there's a about the in this case the U17 Plankton. Mm-hmm.
Cool. So there are even multiple choices for this for the replacement. Mm-hmm. It's cool.
Yeah, I can't see anything about it being still available. So.
Meanwhile, CPLD is a complex programmable logic device, and it is in fact FPGA-like.
Hmm.
So,
all right, there you go.
With complexity between that of PALs and FPGAs, and architectural features of both. So it is it is kind of like simulating the chip. In a sense, but I think that is a really cool thing for these things that are no longer going to be gettable anymore.
Right. All right. That rounds up our eBay auctions, and heading off into the final stretch of the show here. Anybody have anything to add? Paul, you have a thing or two I think you wanted to say here.
Well, over this past weekend, I was at MIT there was a sort of like a conference, and I discovered that on the first floor of the Stata building, they have a big DigiComp 2, which is this particular one. You don't have to buy it in big sizes, but this particular DigiComp 2 was built specifically by evil mad scientists for MIT, and I happened across it and had a chance to spend about 10 minutes like playing with it. But it basically is a big board that it's kind of like a pachinko machine, I guess, or whatever. But you can move little levers around to represent there's an accumulator or something that represents, I think it's 7 or 8 bits. Mm. And then sort of the way the balls fall and tip the levers around, you can sort of program it in a limited way. So I followed the instructions in the manual and made it count, up to 7 or something like that, by dropping. And this thing is actually large enough that the balls that are going down there and flipping the switches are billiard balls. They're 8 balls. So it's something like 3 feet by 6 feet big or something. It's pretty big. That's pretty cool. There's a actual post about it on Evil Mad Scientist's blog about their building this specific one for MIT too.
So it wouldn't look out of place alongside the mega processor.
No, it's a sort of similar concept, possibly even lower tech. But that was fun. I hadn't expected to come across it, and I just saw it there and thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then I guess I mentioned sort of earlier one of the things I'm starting in earnest to do now is kind of preparing for the upcoming Kansas Fest, which we haven't actually mentioned except kind of in passing, but we're getting close. It's now only some weeks away. We will record a couple times before then, but my hope is that I will be able to at least build a transportable Apple III that is at least like an Apple III board with modern things hanging off of it, but we'll see.
Cool. All right. The only thing I was going to toss in here was that a couple weeks ago, I'm sure no one missed that that Prince died, and Prince not being known for being a retro computing guy, as far as I know, but I think most of us came to know Prince's music during a time when a lot of us were in the middle of our 80s computing stuff, at least the people who are our age and above. So, in honor of Prince's passing, I thought we could link out to a nice Purple Rain chiptune remix that I found. So you'll find that in the show notes. And that's all we have for this show. We did it, guys. We're done. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss it in the forums at www.vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. We'll link to that. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group by searching for Retro Computing Roundtable. And please send us email at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We'd love to hear what you think of the show. We'd love to hear if you have anything, any news you want to share with us, or projects you want to talk about, or anything at all. We are a member of the Throwback Network, which exists at throwbacknetwork.net. And please, wherever you download this podcast, whether it's iTunes or something else that you use to listen to this on your Zoom or whatever you're doing, please log in, leave a nice review, give us some stars, because that feeds our egos, basically. And it helps people find the show, we think. I think that's how search works. Like, if like people, like, the more things are liked and talked about, it probably increases search rankings. We don't know. But it probably does. So, do it. And until next time, Retro Compute.